Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, technology, and more. I'm Nick Frank, and I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron.
That's right. I like how you threw the Z in there. XYZ. Yeah. Wait, you can't just say I'm Nick Frank. Where are you from, buddy?
Canada, because I said Z. That was an uncomfortable experience for me saying all that, because I just read it, but I'll get used to it.
Well, I am Aaron. I'm the owner of Golf Custom Knives. And where the fuck are you from, Nick?
Frank Brothers Guitar Company.
That's what I was trying to get at you, dumb. I know. What have you been up to, man? How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, we've been, you know, another busy week. Flew by. Well, it's only Wednesday.
Yeah, it did, eh?
So.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it's, yeah, since our last recording, though, it really does feel like it's flown by.
Yeah. But we've been busy. A new hire started this week.
Ooh.
At Frank Brothers. So we've got a person now helping out in finishing.
Oh, cool.
Really talented guy who's already picked up on everything super quick. Okay. Which is great.
So is this like an apprentice that you're bringing in, like someone that's inexperienced with finishing and is going to learn? Or
no. It's somebody who's got experience sanding and in woodworking, but right. Not in guitar making.
Yes,
which works for us.
Finish. Right.
Yeah, I mean, we need people with good hand skills. We can train them to do the work on our product, but
right.
those hand skills are really key. And to get somebody up and running really quick, that's also right. pretty key. Yeah, so that's been exciting.
Interesting. Do you think that that's the hardest part of training somebody else? Like for me, it was like trying to get someone else to see with your eyes mm-hmm. and to see with your like standards in terms of.
Yes.
You know, do you think that's the hardest bit or is it like teaching them to actually do this stuff?
No, it's teaching tolerance and teaching that feel.
Right.
And, you know, somebody has to, there has to be an aptitude for it or a very strong desire to learn.
Right. Yeah. You know, you can't get someone in that's just like kind of the fuck it good enough. And then.
Exactly. Like you super picky in it's all made up of little things. So
right.
you can wreck something so quick.
Yeah. One little chisel gouge or something.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. How many guitars have you wrecked?
Oh, I have a corner.
Oh yeah, the corner
pile of guitars. I mean, there's probably like six plus guitars there.
Oh, that's not too bad.
It's not so bad. But if I show the mistakes that are on them, some of them are really big, but some of them right. are like, well, you could fix that. But we use them. We'll like test new programs on them because we do a lot of post-finish routing. So right. after the guitar is completely finished, polished, then we put it back on the CNC, right? Pick up cavities, holes for, you know, switches and things right. like that, which freaks people out. I always get the same questions because I post some videos of it on Instagram. People are like, bro, you're going to chip the finish or whatever.
Well, I mean, you have no idea what you're doing. So those are pretty reasonable questions.
Yes. Totally.
Yeah, I mean, it is terrifying. Like, I sometimes put DLC coated knives back in my fixtures to do engraving. And
yeah,
it's, I mean, particularly for me, because I have to clamp down pretty hard and I'm clamping like metal on metal. It's, yeah, it's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, but you know, we wouldn't have a lot of shifting forces, like lateral forces that would... Could you clamp it lighter, or is it...
I could, just my fixtures aren't set up to do that at
all.
So, like, yeah, I'll be clamping them down to use that diamond dragon graver that we were talking about last time. Oh, cool.
Right.
I think at some point I need to make, like a polyethylene cradle, you know, something that's just, like, totally incapable of scratching the knives, and then it has, like, a rubber clamping thing in there or something.
Soft jaws of some sort.
Exactly, yeah.
We have that for putting our bodies back in. And it's basically a clamp itself.
So you clamp the whole body of the guitar in, and then what operations are you doing on that?
That's when we're writing pickup cavities. Mm. And if you're not a guitar guy, I know you're a guitar guy, but if you're not a guitar person, pickups are what make the guitar essentially electric.
Right.
And yeah, typically they're routed before you do any finishing. Having these big cavities in the middle of the body of the guitar makes it hard to sand and polish around. We get way better
thinning the finish out too much.
Yeah, you can get hot spots where you maybe would sand more. Your finish builds up, so this makes it really clean and it's really fun. Put a fully finished guitar that's had 40 hours of work, put it on the CNC and let it just. You know.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome though that you're doing something that's so different to, you know, like different enough that other guitar makers are looking at it being like, oh my god, what are you doing?
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Well, and we didn't come up with the idea. We saw a photo of another guitar company do it and we were like, well, I must do that on everything. So we were just like, let's adopt that. I have no idea if they actually do it on anything,
but it's working.
Company's callings, it works for us. Yeah, right. Nice. But so that's what we've been up to. That's a long way of saying what we've been up to. How about you?
Well, that was one thing. What else have you been up to?
I get to keep going?
Oh, yeah, man. I'll indulge you.
All right, thanks, because you know I can blather on. We ordered some new dust collectors. So to fit the Haas, we had to shift some machinery around. So now we've got like these two woodworking cells. For machinery like our jointer, thickness sanders, table saw, and then we have another cell with a disc and belt sander and a bandsaw. So we got dust collectors to service those. Where previously we have like a big cyclone dust collector that collects all the dust for every machine, but it takes rigid ducting and when you put the machines further away, it doesn't collect them as well. Collect the dust as well.
Right, right.
Something about static pressure loss. I just like saying
pressure.
That. Yeah. Yeah. So now this big cyclone's just going to service the CNC. So now we have to figure out how to do dust collection.
In the Haas, right.
Which I think will be easier than doing it on the axes because the gantry, you know, you've got so much movement there.
Yeah, totally.
And they came with like a dust shoe that you could put on it, but it's mostly made for mostly designed for flat goods.
Yeah.
Chicas.
Yeah, yeah.
So we got to figure that out. And then, we're working with Mark on figuring out how we're going to fixture on the Haas, which is exciting.
Right. And Mark's the guy that does all of your like CNC programming, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
We collaborate on all that and he does the actual CAD and CAM.
Because he's a nerd and you're a cool guy. You're too cool for
him. Yeah. I mean, that's what my business card says. Chief cool officer.
So what are you thinking for fixture plates? Because like, how big's the table on your machine again? It's
The travel is 20 by 30. The table is 18 by 36.
Right. So I guess you can put a finished guitar in there to like route the cavities and stuff, like the pickup cavities, but you'll be like hanging the neck out over the way covers.
Yes. And actually, if we put the guitar centered on the table, which we're inclined to do because it looks nice,
right?
It'll actually go through the window on the Haas, because the Haas has a window on either side of the machine.
Right.
But the idea is we're going to actually keep that window open and build in a dust port there. That'll be more like a filtration, like an air filtration.
Right. Just keep like negative pressure inside.
So we'll duct out of that and hook it up to the dust collector. So the neck will actually stick into that a little.
I thought it works.
Yeah. I mean, because the next step was going to a VF3 or, you know, and then it's like a couple thousand dollars more to go to a VF4. It's very tempting. But we have limited space and we have limited ceiling height. So the VF2, we got the SS, we got the YT, the extended Y travel. So we have the 20 inches in Y versus, I think it's 16 for just the VF2. And it gives us a nice big, it's a big enough work surface or machine. Right. It's a 20 inch Z versus 25 for, I think it is the VF3.
Gotcha. So, and that's just like just a little bit too much.
If we put the Z all the way up, then the spindle, like, you know, the enclosure around the spindle, the whole thing moves up and down. It would blast right through our natural gas line in the ceiling. We didn't want to do that.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound apocalyptic.
Just bend it out of the way, maybe. That would have would have worked.
Yeah. I've been wondering about travels on CNC machines myself as well. So I'm working on a kitchen knife at the moment.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. And because kitchen knives are so different to what I'm doing at the moment, like the outdoors knives. They're very long and thin in comparison, which means that fixturing them, I have to take a different approach. So what I'm actually going to be doing is starting with a rectangular steel blank, hardening that, and then doing all of the machining on it hard rather than just the bevel operations. And I'm actually going to be tabbing it out. So I'll be doing of the 3D machining and then tabbing it out, breaking it free of the tabs manually, and then putting it on a final fixture that will locate it by the handle pins and then trim the tabs and the profile in one shot.
In those tabs, will they be on at the edge of the blade?
Yeah.
The sharp edge?
So those ones I actually don't care about. I can't really trim those because the steel there is so thin that, like, no matter how I fixture it, it's going to like chatter like crazy.
Right.
But I don't care about those because I can just sharpen them away.
True.
Right.
So like the other surface, you want that to be the final finish.
Yeah. It has to be like, you know, on the spine of the knife and around the handle and stuff. It all has to be final finish and also like to a really close tolerance. Hmm. I'm holding the tolerance between my handle scales and the tang of my knives to about 1 thou total tolerance. So it's like plus or minus half a thou.
On your,
on the resolute.
Wow. Yeah. And so you're going to have to hold that over a longer, a larger.
Well, the handle is about the same size as the handle and the resolute. Yeah. Okay. So it'll be fine. It'll be about the same, but that's kind of like, I want that because at that level of fit, it feels like the handle has been made as like one piece with the blade. Like you can't feel a step, you know?
Right.
Which is really sweet.
Yeah.
The problem is that, so what I really want to do is set up the machine. So previously I had, the steel machining and the composite machining for the handle scales. I had all that happening in one machine. I actually want to split that up for two reasons. One, the like steel machining cycles take way longer. I can kind of do the handle scales on demand because they're fast enough.
Okay.
And I want to get all of the, so I want to get like one kitchen knife, one hunting knife, and one unnamed folding knife on the table all at the same time so that each cycle makes one of each knife.
Right.
And then additionally, I'll actually be able to recycle my steel because right now I'm not recycling.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's all of the G10. Exactly.
Dang. They don't just melt that away?
No. Damn. They just like laugh in your face. I mean it's not a huge problem because I don't make that much scrap,
right,
you know, compared to pretty much any other machining company, but I'd still like to do better, you know. So the problem is that I can't quite fit all of that on the table of my current machine.
Hmm. What's the travel again?
It's 20 by 16.
Right.
On the X and Y. So I did read somewhere that someone was, you know, so one of the interesting things about the Fidal control is that everything is a parameter. Like, I can go into the control on my machine and tell it that the travels are like 60 inches by 30 inches, and it'll just be like, okay.
But is there not a limit switch?
There are no limit switches, no.
Is there like a block that it runs into?
Yeah, there's a hard limit. Right. Well, I mean, at some point you're going to run out of machine.
Yeah, runway. Yeah. but how much further can you go?
So there was a model up from mine in size called the 2216, which just gives you an extra 2 inches in X. And the funny thing is that my machine has the rails long enough to do that.
Really?
Yeah.
You just made the table smaller?
I think it's the same size table and everything. I think the only thing that they made different is that the ball screws are just a tiny bit too short. I think. I'm not 100% sure. Because, like, if you look at the ball nut, the end of the ball screw would actually be inside the ball nut by about a half an inch. And I'm not sure whether that's going to be enough to, like, let the ball bearings fall out, or whether it, you know, just the first half an inch is just all mounting flange, you know? It might be that the first half inch is just mounting flange, and then I don't have to make any changes to the machine at all. I can just change that parameter to be 22 inches in X, and then I'm good.
That would be amazing.
I've heard that other people have done it, but I know that I read it somewhere, and now I can't find the place where the person was saying that they did it.
That's a hard thing to Google.
Yeah, exactly.
Would the alternative be actually changing the ball screws?
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny, in my first machine, I actually bought the wrong Z-axis ball screw when I was rebuilding that machine. So it's only a 20-inch Z-axis, like the travel, but it actually has a 28-inch ball screw in it. So I could actually swap that. There's like a ton of extra room under the bottom. It just hangs out.
That's hilarious.
It's fine. Like it's inside the way covers
just
and everything.
Dangling,
so it's not a big
out
deal.
Of the...
Just dangling.
There you go.
Yeah. So I could actually swap the X and Z ball screws on that machine, and then I could get like 28 inches of travel. I mean, I'd destroy my linear rails, but so
could you, but if you change just the code, I don't know,
just the parameter,
the parameter, right. Then it won't go out of that and your linear rails will be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant.
Theoretically. So yeah, we'll see. I think I'm going to try it because like it just that extra 2 inches lets me build a fixture that's way nicer than if I have to work around
that. Isn't that amazing that it's just 2 inches?
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. So, and kind of along with that, I've been looking at, like, you know, I'm all jelly over here because you've got your new machine. I'm jealous. Mm-hmm. I want to hug it, but you won't let me. So, you know, I've been kind of looking at it and being like, okay, like, what's the next step for me? Do I need a new machine?
Mm-hmm.
I've wanted a new machine forever, right? But, like, I still don't quite think it makes sense. But there's a company that makes upgrade controls for Fidals. And it's, like, a pretty substantial upgrade. It's both in price and performance. compared to a new machine, it's incredibly cheap. It's, like, $15,000. Canadian.
Right.
What
advantages would that give you over the current control?
Double the resolution on all of the axes for, like, so you have to replace all of the encoders.
Okay.
And it's at the least double the resolution. I think I can negotiate with them to get better encoders, and then it'd be like 10 times the resolution. It actually has, so the Fidal control actually doesn't do any look ahead. Mm-hmm. So when you have your G code and you're coming up to like a hard 90 degree corner, you know, a modern control like on your Haas will look at that corner and be like, well, I can't do that corner at 900 inches a minute.
Right.
So I need to slow down a little bit to get that corner and to keep those tolerances. Whereas the Fidal will just be like, yeah, fucking send it. You know, like it doesn't do any look ahead. It doesn't do any changing of feed rates. It basically, it'll keep just trying to do whatever you program until the servos overload.
I love that confidence though.
Yeah, I mean it's full send. It really does give it, but yeah. So the problem is that style of control works mostly. But if you like try to do a 90 degree outside 90 degree corner, so you're like trying to machine the outside of a square feature, it'll hit that corner and then it'll start going in the 90 degree direction, like it'll make the turn. But on that second face, there'll actually be like an oscillation because the servo has overshot the end of that corner, and then it's having to correct.
Right.
So your feed rate's kind of limited by like how much quality you're willing to give up.
So you have to slow down the entire length, that entire cut.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to make a nice right angle turn or yes. a curve for whatever.
Yeah, and obviously that gets way more complicated once you start trying to do 3D contouring.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, basically this other control does like full look ahead. It does like, you know, planning for all that kind of stuff. It works out how much acceleration it has, and if any move that you command exceeds that amount of acceleration, then it will alter the move to like smooth things out, you know, like the Haas does.
So a new control... switching ball bearings, moving them around.
I actually wouldn't have to switch anything, the ball screws or anything.
Ball screws, rather. Well, you were just talking about doing that to extend.
Yeah, changing the settings. Yeah. I don't know if I would actually have to swap anything.
Oh, you potentially
I may have to. Right. I'm not sure.
But you're talking about switching encoders.
Yeah.
Like, how long would all that take you?
Not too long. I think it'd be probably a couple of days to install the new control. I mean, luckily I know that machine pretty well.
I know, right? I'm just, you know, I'm curious about like is a value proposition. What could a new machine, how can I get you into new Haas today?
The biggest thing for me is finish quality. So the biggest issue that I have with the Fidal, okay, so like, I don't care about the speed of the Fidal. It's good enough. I don't care really about the travels. It's good enough. Like, everything is good enough except for repeatability. So if you're trying to do lots and lots of passes back across, back and forth across an angled surface, you know, like 3D contouring a surface, sometimes it'll run a little bit low and sometimes it'll run a little bit high. And so you end up with these streaks in the surface.
Right.
That then I have to, like, those streaks are the reason that I still have to hand finish every one of my blades.
Right.
So, you know, a better control with better encoders. Because the problem is my machine at the moment doesn't have encoders. It has the thing that predated encoders called resolvers, which are literally analog. So it's actually a really cool system. It's like two coils. One is fixed and one is rotating. And one's outputting a sine wave, and then the other one's just picking up whatever the other one's putting out. And by reading kind of the angle of the sine wave that's coming out of that second, like, it's basically like a guitar pickup just attached to a servo motor. By reading the angle of that sine wave, it can tell how far the servo is rotated.
Wow.
But this is all implemented with, like, 1994 technology.
Right.
You know, so, like... You know, these days, like the digital to analog or the analog to digital converter in your like in your phone is better than the thing that's in this super expensive machine. Right? So, yeah, like I think switching to actual encoders that are, you know, digital from the ground up, have a much higher resolution, then having all of that extra brains around acceleration and deceleration, I think that would make a big difference in my surface finishes, and that's.
So I guess the hesitation to maybe dive into a brand new machine is that it still doesn't get you to where you want to be, whereas this could do the same thing as just getting a new machine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think if I was to go to like a Haas VF or a VM series machine, especially the VM series machines, because they're like the mold making.
Yeah,
machines.
That would make sense for you because you're doing all that. Well, you want the highest resolution possible.
Exactly. So I think that would get me there. But the problem is, you know, in my current shop, that means I would have to get rid of my current working machines. Mm-hmm. I would, you know, potentially not have enough space. It's a much larger investment and so on. You know, so if I could do like an incremental upgrade,
right?
You know, it's not going to retain its value as an investment as well as like buying a Haas.
Right.
But to me, Because the investment's relatively small, you know, compared to a new machine, it doesn't really matter. Like, I would get my value out of it very quickly.
But you have to drop $15,000
in cash right now.
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, that might be the down payment on a Haas.
Well, and then you get to make 3 years of payments after that.
Yeah, which you can look forward to.
Yeah, exactly.
And they, yeah, you know, I mean, do you know they can they retain a the ability to shut your machine down if you miss payments?
Yes, yeah, I've heard that,
which is exciting. So when they were here installing mine, mm-hmm. they had a timer on. It said, like, this machine's operational for the next 30 days. And I was like, what the fuck is that? And he was like, oh, we put this on all new machines. It'll stop working after 30 days unless you put a code in. And I was like, well, I need you to take, because we bought ours outright.
Right.
It's like, I need you to take that off right now. I'm not letting you leave without removing that. Because what if, you know, America declares war on Canada and they shut all our Haas machines?
We're coming for your maple syrup.
Yeah. No, but like, I don't know where I read that, but somebody had said, you know, buying a machine from some other country, they could always turn it off,
right?
if you had some dispute.
Well, the crazy thing is, like, with five-axis machines, so like five-axis machines are regulated under the International Trade of Arms,
right?
Because they can, like, theoretically be used to make nuclear weapons, right? So a lot of vendors of five-axis machines, like, if you move the machine, it has like a GPS tracker built in.
Oh, right.
And if it senses that it's been moved, it shuts itself down.
To
and
North
you have
Korea.
To, like, yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah.
Apparently,
you have to have, like, it's to sell one of those on the used market is a different thing, story as well.
Right.
But I don't know. That was a tangent. I'm not actually worried about them turning my machine off, but
you're not shipping your Fidel to North Korea anytime soon?
I haven't had any offers,
you know? it's offers on the dock incoming plan. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a good way to turn a quick profit, probably better than the guitar business. Anyways, that's an interesting, it's fun to think about that stuff. I think obviously what you've done with that machine is like amazing, and
it's definitely been like, you know, when people are like, why are you buying a shitty Fidel, whatever, you know, like, yeah, it's not the greatest machine in the world, but I didn't pay a ton for it, and I was able to, like, pay for it incrementally, you know, like, so that new machine, like, it literally cost me $3,900.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I spent about 12 or 14 grand on, like, I had to replace a bunch more electrical stuff than I thought. Like, I replaced two servo drives, the spindle motor, spindle drive, and some other stuff, screen and so on, right? But the machine's in really good condition now, and I was able to kind of do it incrementally. I was able to do it on my terms. You know?
Yeah.
So, which, like,
That makes a lot of sense for you, because, you know, like,
yeah,
you're stubborn.
It just freaks me out, the idea of, like,
your own way.
Yeah, it freaks me out, the idea of, like, so look, I know that some debt is constructive debt, and, like, I have debt right now. I'm not, like, you know, some debt-free hippie, but, like, I hate the idea that, like, you know, I have a line of credit or whatever, and sure, if I have to, I can just put the minimum on that next month. It's no big deal. Yeah. You know, whereas, like, a machine payment, like, you know, you got to make it or else they're gonna turn your machine off.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. No, it's not the most ideal situation for sure, mm-hmm, to have that. But also, I mean, can, like you said, it can be, if you had one of those in your shop, how much more productive could you potentially be? Maybe no more productive, maybe a lot more productive. It could be, you know, really,
totally.
It could make things easy, make your life a lot easier.
Well, one of the reasons that I haven't wanted to do that is because I'm actually not taking advantage of the full potential for productivity that I currently have.
Right.
And there's a bunch of, I think, I don't know if I told you this, but, like, the guy that lives in, so there's a guy that lives in the unit next to me, right?
The welder.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to keep him up at night, so I'm not running the machines overnight. But if I had my own shop out in the country on a property or something, I would 100% run the machines unattended every night.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a free cycle. So, like, I'm not particularly worried about getting, like, more productivity, right, until I've already, like, you know, if I'm getting like, you know, 24 hours of spindle on time a day, and that's not enough productivity, then at that point the productivity argument makes sense. But that's right now, it's just like a quality argument, you know.
Yeah, and like you said, you know, it might not translate to, you know, you still might be stuck doing a boatload of handwork.
Right. Which yeah, I really hope that would not be the case.
So, like, I've watched like the whole Grimsmo thing where he's like gone from milling the knives to now grinding them on a 5-axis.
Yes, his that machine that he has, the Kern.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're talking about John Grimsmo, who's a knife maker also here in Canada. And he's an acquaintance. I don't know him super well, but he and I are on good terms. And some of the machines he has are crazy.
Wow.
And that Kern 5-axis is the craziest. Yeah. Like, I think it's got like 140 station tool changer in that thing.
It might be 200
or something like that. It's a huge number. It's just ridiculous. Maybe 100. Yeah.
I don't know.
Super cool.
Really cool. The pallet changing, pallet changer, and he's got all those tombstones in it. Very, very cool. That's a neat machine for sure.
Yeah. And at some point that thing is going to be running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with the pallet pool unattended, yeah. You know,
he's an example of somebody that was like, I'm just going to buy the very best machine I can conceivably afford.
Right.
And just go for it. So
yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think part of the difference is actually that my market is smaller. So John is selling folding knives, and you know, folding knives, everyone lives in the city these days. So like, you know, you can live in the city and have a folding knife. But that totally makes sense. But like my market for making like hunting knives and outdoors knives, mm-hmm. it's much, much smaller.
Right.
You know, and I've talked to, big knife companies, and they're saying that, you know, the kind of knives I make are like less than 15% of their overall market.
Right.
So,
but they don't make a Goff custom knife.
No.
And that's a special knife. So
that is a special.
I don't know.
Ooh, speaking of special knives. So I did a knife for a fellow knife maker the other day, Jeff Fader. And this was a really fun project because I just said to him, like, look, man, can I like take my time with this and make something special for you? And he was like, yeah, man, like, cool. Go do whatever you want. So I ended up doing, so my normal knives are matte finished with sandblasting, and then they're DLC coated, which like it's diamond like carbon. So it's a very thin black diamond-ish coating. It's super, super hard. But the really cool thing about that finish is that it's only like a micron thick. So whatever the surface finish underneath, that's what it shows up as. Right. Like it doesn't hide anything, you know? Like, and when I say that it like perfectly reflects the finish underneath, they actually use DLC to make mirrors for like scientific optics that cool. only reflect infrared. Wow. Like, yeah, super, super, super cool shit. So I did a knife for him with satin finished bevels. So like hand sanded bevels. And then all of the spine and the tang and everything was all matte sandblasted. And then I did DLC on top of that.
Cool. So the sandblast and satin have a different texture.
Yeah, yeah. So
what's the
sandblast is like
satin
totally matte.
Sandblast?
The satin is like just doing pull strokes with sandpaper. So
oh,
you just
it's like a brushed
perfectly
satin.
Yes, yeah. You get like perfectly straight lines. Yeah. So that those are like sanding marks going from tip to tail.
Right.
You know, it's applied by hand very carefully. And then doing the so it's, yeah, it's like a black brushed satin finish.
Yeah, that
with
is...
then like black matte on the spine stuff. Super cool. That was a really fun knife to do.
That is really cool. Have you showed photos of that yet?
I have not. I actually haven't posted anything to Instagram in over a month.
Oh, really? Yeah. Man, I want to see that. It's hard to find time to post stuff to Instagram.
Yeah, and I'm a little so like this was a prototype, a one-off, and like I'm always a little hesitant to post stuff like that because I know people are going to be like, I want it,
oh,
make
yeah.
me one,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It's so hard to say no.
I know,
but this knife was so much work. like I made three of them, and only one came out
close
to being right. You know, there was still some stuff about it that I didn't quite like. Like this finish is really, really fussy to get right.
And then you don't know necessarily, I suppose, until it comes back from from the coding.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because and, you can, and the DLC coding always like brings out the worst in things.
Yes.
Or the best, yeah. Also the best in things, you know, because like obviously he's going to help beautify that object, but any,
yeah. Any flaws just become more obvious.
Magnified.
Yeah. And it's made even worse because the DLC coding has issues of its own. So, you know, if you were spraying lacquer and you accidentally had like a little drop of oil or silicone on there, you would get like a fisheye, like a blister in your finish. You can get the same kind of stuff with DLC. So I have to keep my sandblasting cabinet like surgically clean, like nothing that has oil on it goes in there ever. Because then I'd just be blasting oil into the like matte sandblasted texture. And then that oil will off gas in the vacuum chamber when they're trying to do the DLC and it'll cause problems. You know, so if you literally take like a freshly sandblasted blade and you put a fingerprint on it and then you send it to DLC, you know, they ultrasonically clean them, but there's a good chance that knife's coming back with a fingerprint.
Really?
In the DLC.
You can have to ultrasonic cleaning.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I understand what ultrasonic cleaning really does, because how is it not removing that?
So the fucked thing is that it's not actually like the oil. The problem in this case is that the steel that I use for most of my knives isn't stainless. So when you put a thumbprint on this like fresh, untouched surface, you end up creating a little tiny oxide layer in the shape of your thumbprint.
Gotcha.
That, you know, it doesn't clean off because it's an oxide layer. And then that changes the appearance of the DLC over the top of it.
So ultrasonic would clean off oil.
Yeah.
But not the oxides. Coolant or something.
Yeah.
So do you know how ultrasonic works though?
Yeah, it's super cool, man.
I would like to know.
So basically you've got like a speaker in the water, right? Mm. You know, it's like having a tweeter from a sound system. So it's making really, really high frequency noise, and that sound is traveling through the water as pressure waves. And what happens is it's actually tearing open small bubbles of vacuum, because you get the pressure waves kind of going away from each other. And then in between those pressure waves, it actually tears open a tiny bubble of vacuum in the water. And when that little bubble of vacuum collapses, it kind of deforms into a torus shape, and then it makes a jet of water. And that little tiny jet of water is so energetic that they're actually investigating it to see whether they can start fusion reactions inside the jet created by ultrasonic cavitation. So that whole process is called cavitation, and it's something that they actually fight really hard against on like high performance boats and ships and on submarines, because if you get cavitation, that same kind of cavitation happening around your propeller, it'll actually eat the propeller.
Whoa.
Yeah. So yeah, ultrasonic cleaners are amazing. I have a little one at the shop and they are super, super cool.
I knew you'd be able to explain that. The only thing that would have made it better would be if you had like a whiteboard in front of you.
Let me get my whiteboard. I'll draw you the donut cavitation of death on it. Yeah. Yeah, they're super cool, man. They're some like space age technology right there.
That's wild. Cool. Yeah. That was a tangent that I invited. I don't know what we were talking about before that.
Well, we were just, I just said space age. Should we talk about space?
You're going to want to talk about SpaceX.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I did watch it.
You watched?
Well, not live.
Right.
But it was wild.
Yeah, man. So yeah, SpaceX sent 4 more astronauts to the International Space Station. And this is the first time humans have ever flown on a reused booster assembly. So like that's SpaceX's like whole claim to fame. That's why they're doing so many more launches than anyone else these days, because they're reusing stuff rather than throwing it away. So yeah, it's super awesome.
That kicks ass. Right? Also, they look good doing it.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, everything's like shiny and white, and they've got nice spacesuits and stuff.
Yeah, and like the screen inside. You know, I picture like when I think of you know, this like sending a rocket into space, I think of Apollo 13. You know, and it's like
yeah, big switches and stuff,
buttons and switches and stuff. Yep. Yeah, And this is like, the guy was like scrolling on like a touch screen shit. Which
well, and the crazy thing is, that like,
it would be weird if they were like, you know, still had.
Well, but Russian Soyuz capsules, which are until the Dragon capsule came along, the Soyuz capsule was the one that was being used for all of the crewed missions to the International Space Station. And that shit is still like big buttons and switches and like computers from the 80s.
Yeah.
And like they're building them new. They're not like reusing old ones.
That's sick.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting too. So the Nick was talking about the user interface inside the Dragon capsule. The you know, so they sit in front of these three massive screens and they're all touchscreen and everything. And the really interesting thing that I think reflects SpaceX's pragmatism is that that whole system is actually programmed in Electron, which is like the same kind of application system that like Slack, the computer app, is made in. Like it's nothing fancy. They were just like, you know what, that shit's good enough. Works. Send it to space. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, super cool, right?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty amazing what they are doing. I'm not super into it. Like I dig the whole thing, but
not a space nerd like me.
I've had bouts of space nerdism.
did you see the doctor for that or what?
Yeah.
You're cured now. Good to know.
But no, I'm getting back into it since you're into it. You're inspiring me to check it out.
Dude, I mean just
delve a little further.
Right. I just want to go, man. Like it'd be super cool. You just ride a controlled bomb. You just ride a bomb to space.
That's funny because when I watched this, I literally said out loud, I was like, I would never do that.
No, I'm all over it. I'd be 100% in.
You would do a Mars. Like... You would do a like the Mars mission, knowing you'd never return.
Ooh, am I dying there in like
maybe like of old age
a year?
No,
or old age.
Old age.
Yeah, I'd consider it. I mean, you know, like I enjoy what I do. I make nice knives, but like. You know, if I was like solving manufacturing problems to like keep a colony alive on Mars, like that's some cool shit right there.
So you do it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
See, I'd fling my body into space. you not so much though, by the sense.
Well, no, it's just like maybe once I was there, I'd be cool with that. But I don't even like, you know, I get car sick, if somebody else is driving.
Okay, dude, so it's a 3-month trip in a tiny tin can and you're not really sure whether you're going to be into it until we get there. I'm taking you out of this trip, man.
That's wise.
You're excluded.
That's wise.
Yeah. Imagine we get there and then you're like, I want to go home.
Yeah, that would be me for sure.
We'd have to kill you and eat you.
Yeah, I would want that though, like, because I don't know,
put me out of my misery.
Exactly. I'd be the first to go, like if there was like a survival situation, like shipwreck. You know, that just doesn't appeal to me. Just take me.
I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah,
I get it. Hey, man. So guess what? You've got your first listener question.
Me?
Yeah, you. You specifically. No fooling. So Atraxia Guitars on Instagram said, a question for Nick. Can you describe how you cut your fret slots? How many passes? How long does it take to cut all the slots? Have you ever tried using the entire length of each slot as a very gradual ramp down and then return across the bottom of the slot to get rid of the ramp? I think he just wants to know all your secrets, bud.
All my fret slotting secrets?
All your fret slotting secrets. So for people that don't know, can you tell us what the hell a fret is and why it would be hard to cut the slots for these things?
Sure. The fret goes on the playing surface of the guitar. And it's the shiny metal bit. Across the fretboard, and when right, you press your finger on the string, the fret is what shortens the string and creates the pitch of the note. Wow,
beautiful.
That sounded bad.
It's such a hard thing to explain, man. Like I was thinking about that on the way home. I was like, how do you explain that to someone that's like never held a guitar?
Yeah, well, think about it. If you have a rubber band, you shorten it or extend it, like it changes the pitch.
Yeah,
it's similar to that, I guess.
except it's metal and it's on the guitar. So why are the fret slots so hard to cut? Like, why is this a big deal?
They're really narrow. They're really thin. So right. Traditionally, they'd be cut with a handsaw. Or like, okay, if you look at a violin or a contrabass, upright bass, they don't have frets. You just
they
have to
fretless.
Know where to put your finger.
Right.
They're fretless, yeah. So that was an innovation at some point where you wouldn't have to just know where to put your finger.
You just know at some point someone objected. They were like, we don't want plebs playing this simple,
this
dumbed down
easy.
Thing. Yeah, exactly. Where's all the skill and craftsmanship gone? You know?
Yeah. So a fret is made up of, there's a tang, and that's the narrow part that is embedded and into the fretboard. And that's what holds the fret in place. So a slot accepts the tang. And then on top of that, there's a crown, and that is what sits on top of the fretboard. And it comes to a peaked shape. And that's what the note is. Well, that's what the string is being depressed against. So the fret tang is about 23 thou of an inch wide. So
wide.
The slot has to be 23 thou.
And how deep is it?
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head, but
I think they're about like a bit over a 16.
I'm literally sitting in front of a boatload of stuff. I'll just
measure. Do you want me to jump on StuMac real quick and look it up?
Yeah, the 60 thou.
60 thou. Yeah, so just over a 16. Or just under a 16, sorry.
So you would cut it by hand with a handsaw, or then, you know, like Fender or Gibson, they were using maybe like gang saws. So it would have this, if this, say your fretboard has 22 slots, it would have 22 blades on it, all spaced out.
Right.
The proper distances. And that would cut them. With the CNC machine, you just do it one at a time with a really tiny end mill. So we use a 23 thou diameter end mill.
Is that like a single flute end mill, or is
it's two
flute?
Two flute.
A two flute 23 thou end mill. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's a little guy.
I bet.
And so it's a that's a fragile tool. So we don't do it all in one pass, but we also don't. How our fret, we don't make our fret slot exactly the diameter or the width of the diameter of that bit. We don't make it 23 thou because
we make it wider, right?
Because if you put a 23 thou tang with barbs, so they have little like barbs sticking out of it that help it grip into the fretboard,
right into the wood.
Yeah, you stuff that into this board that's got 22 of these slots. It's essentially kerfed. And you start jamming these things that are the same size, you get this effect called compression fretting. And it compresses the fretboard and it back bows the neck.
Right. It makes it curved away from the playing surface.
Exactly. Right. So we have our fret slots a bit wider. So the
and
barb,
then how do you hold the
still,
tang in
the
then?
Barbs still stick in.
Oh, okay.
So I can't remember exactly. I mean, we dialed this in years ago, and we fussed with it a lot.
Right.
So we actually used to, even the closer we got to where, so the further up the fretboard you get, the closer to the body, the tighter the frets are together. And we had our fret slots start getting wider at that point.
Right. To reduce the amount of like
compression
force that you're putting into the
fretboard. Yeah. Because you would start to see a hump there from compression fretting. Since then, we've sort of just figured out the best
general size.
Slot, I wish I could tell you, because I'd be happy to share that information, but I can't recall.
It's some size.
We're working within thousands of an inch, so it's maybe it's 25.
It's not like 10 thou bigger.
No. So we do step down. We actually we cut them on the radius. We route them on the radius of the same radius as the fretboard. So
right. So it's not a flat bottom slot.
It's not a flat bottom slot.
It's actually a curved bottom slot.
And that helps give the neck more rigidity because you're leaving more material there. Mm. And then our final pass, we do, I believe, in one full pass.
Yeah, that makes sense. But any idea of like how much you're stepping down, like how many step downs you're taking?
I think we're doing 10,000 steps, step downs.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would go pretty quick if you're running like, I guess you're like on your router spindle, you're probably running 30,000 RPM or something.
We're going full tilt, which is 21,000 RPM.
Okay.
But the Haas won't be able to do that. It can only do 15.
Right. But are you going to get a speeder for doing fret slots?
No, I thought about it, but no. 15 will do it because there are points where like we were doing like 20 or thou, like the router bit can handle a bigger cut. But so I think that's what we'll end up doing is just taking a bigger cut or just running slower.
Right. Yeah. You might find too that like little delicate tools might actually be a bit more robust in the Haas than they were in the router because they're getting them moved around more smoothly.
Right.
Rather than kind of jerking around. And yeah, there's less run out. And I think the toolpaths will be like more tightly constrained. You know, they're it's going to be like less juddering about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what happens.
Well, yeah. And I would say for if you're playing around with that, not a lot of harm in trying to push it. Like we can get about 20 fretboards out of one of those.
Oh, wow.
Router bits. We get them from precisebits.com, I think is what it's called. Right. And it's a shell mill. It's the shell cutter. It's not, shell we don't cutter. Use the fret slotting bit. I think they sell it. I don't know if it's different, but it's the one that's made for cutting shell, like pearl.
Right.
Or abalone. So that's what we use. And yeah, you can push those little bits pretty good. So. And also, and surface finish, like your surface finish isn't that critical, obviously, because it's like being completely hidden. So I just say,
but I know you guys care about it anyway.
Yeah, it's polished.
Yeah.
I would say go for it. Just give her hell.
And there you go. 10,000 step downs, a little bit wider than the Tang, and let her rip.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah, that's way smaller than any tool I've ever used. I'm going to be getting down into tools that kind of size when I start working on my folding knife prototypes.
Right.
Because there are some pretty small features in that thing. But yeah, like right now, like the smallest tool I use is 3/32.
And what do you use that for?
I actually use that to interpolate, like to helically bore the pinholes in the steel of the Tang and in the handle scales for my knives.
Oh, cool. Do you know what kind of tolerance you're holding with something like that? Like, how do you measure
the? I measure the holes with plug gauges.
Ah, that makes sense. And can you measure concentricity with that?
Well, I mean, they're not concentric to anything.
Okay.
They're like positioned relative to the outline of the handle scales. It actually really sucks, like because my knives are such. You know, it's a weird shape. It's not like a circle in a circle or something. They're actually really hard to measure.
Right. You know, it's like so contoured and there's no flat reference surface.
Yeah. There's only one reference surface on my outdoors knife that I can measure with a micrometer.
Right.
And that's like from the tip of the finger guard to the spine of the knife.
Mm-hmm.
By measuring that distance, I can tell whether or not I've held the overall profile to size, but I can't tell whether or not that profile is in the correct position relative to the handle pins. Which is really difficult because I'm actually doing the profile of the blade, of the outline of the blade in a separate operation to when I'm drilling the handle pins.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a little bit dicey at times, but basically my handle scales actually act as my like master, because the handle scales are all machined in one operation. Every critical surface is machined in one operation, so those are about as accurate a part as I can possibly make.
How do you do that? Like, how are you work holding that?
So basically I have a preparatory operation that actually machines bolt holes in the underside of the handle scales. And then I bolt the G10, like the composite material, onto a pallet, and then that pallet gets fixed down to the table. So you can't see any mounting hardware from the top. It's all underneath.
Right.
And then that lets me get access to all of the top side and the, you know, five-sided machining.
Cool.
on the handle scale.
And you can profile right to the very bottom of that.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Yeah, no problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, because trying to hold that tolerance, for a while there, every single handle scale that I made was off position relative to, like, the outline relative to the pinholes by 5/1000ths. And I could not work out where this was coming from. And it was enough that I could feel it on the edges of the knife. So I was having to, like, hand sand every single pair of handle scales that came off.
They were undersized or they were oversized?
No, they were off position.
Oh.
Like, they were offset in one direction.
Oh, that's so annoying.
Yeah, super annoying. You know, so poor Mike had to, like, hand sand, like, so many handle scales for, like, a year because I really wasn't able to work this out. And it turns out in that whole time, I had never replaced the drill bit that I was using to drill the pinholes in the G10 because it was still drilling on size. So I didn't think there was a problem. But I guess the tip must have dulled. And so it was walking off its position. But it was walking off position in a perfectly repeatable way.
That's so bizarre.
Right? So it wasn't like it was random, you know, because if it was walking in a random direction, then the handle scales wouldn't actually fit on the knife. I don't have 5 thou of slop.
Right.
You know? But it was all walking in the same direction, 5/1000ths of an inch.
That's bizarre. I mean, maybe because it was like, is it drilling into kind of a ramped surface?
Yeah, but it was ramped in the other direction.
Oh, what the fuck?
yeah, exactly. So yeah, it took me, like, I created a post on Practical Machinist. I was like, guys, please help me. Like, I have no idea what the fuck is going on. And it was literally like 4 days of, like, just changing things and trying new stuff. And in the end, I was just like, you know what, fuck it. And I changed every tool in the magazine, like every tool that was going to be used on the handle scales. And as soon as I changed the drill bit, it started working perfectly.
That's amazing.
So now I don't trust drill bits for anything. Like, I previously didn't trust them for, like, drilling on position in steel, but I thought that, like, oh, it would be good enough for G10. Like, G10's soft. It's a composite, like, fiberglass. You know, it's going to be fine. But no. So now I helically bore those holes with an end mill as well to keep position.
Interesting. So drilling is not accurate?
No. No.
We don't drill anything. Actually, we have, like, very few drilling operations, but that kind of tolerance wouldn't be unacceptable in those operations. But that's interesting. Like, what kind of drill bits are you using? Are you using, like, stub nose or?
I was using stub length solid carbide drill bits.
And are they? I totally forgot what I was just going to ask. But
yeah.
Are you pre-drilling
or spotting?
Yeah. Are you doing pecking?
Yes, I was pecking.
So I've heard there's issues with pecking, like, in terms of holding accuracy.
I don't think there'd be issues in terms of hole location, because once you've started the hole, it's very hard for the drill bit to then wander off.
Right.
Because it can't really cut on the sides. In harder materials, though, there can be issues with tool life if you peck. Sometimes you might be better off just running straight through.
Right.
Because when you peck, you're basically pulling the cutting lips of the drill up against the chip that you've already made.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes that can, like, chip out little bits of the cutting lip of the drill, particularly with carbide. So, yeah. But, man, it literally took me, like, a year and a half to fix that problem.
Wow. And that's a good lesson, though.
Because I was like, there's no way it can be the drill bit. Like, I'm not even investigating that. That's a stupid idea. You know, there's no way. And
that's probably the cheapest bit you have in that entire machine, I'm imagining.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like a $9 drill
bit.
You know, like,
this is funny. Yeah. So we have, sometimes you get, like, when you're assembling a guitar and you string it up, you're like, what the fuck is that buzz coming from? You, like, check the frets. And you're like, now we've learned the first thing to do, if you can't immediately, it's a high fret or something weird like that. Just change the strings, because that's just a manufactured item that could be.
Some strings will just have like a loose winding or something, and they'll buzz.
Could be just a bad string.
Oh wow, that's weird.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, but my point is sometimes it's the simplest solution.
100%, man. Yeah, and those are ones that bite you because you assume that it can't be that.
Right. You convince yourself.
And then it makes a mockery of you.
Like it did in makes you case. Look like a damned fool.
Yeah, I literally made like a post on Practical Machinist, you know, and it was interesting. Like, I was like looking at the G code. I'm like simulating G code on a line by line basis. I'm like, there must be a problem with Fusion. Like, it's doing something weird. I'm like checking the backlash on my machine and like the pitch compensation and like all this complicated shit.
Replacing all the ball screws.
Yeah, thank God I didn't go that far. I was tempted. But yeah, it was just maddening.
That is
yeah.
frustrating.
Absolutely maddening.
So that was a fun question. Did you get any questions?
I did, but we're out of time. I think now's a good spot to put a pin in it, which is amazing. Today really like flew by.
Yeah, no kidding. All right.
That's fine. We've got some extra questions for next week. I'm going to be introducing a new segment next week. Pretty excited about this. Oh. It's called Aaron Reads Mean Comments.
Oh, can we get a taste? I feel like everybody would listen for another 5 minutes for a taste of Aaron Reads Mean Comments.
Doesn't even have to be. It's just one. I just got this one this morning and I was just like, guy, are you serious? So this was, I'm going to just call him out. This was by Luke on YouTube. And he said, you still making these fake ass knives? Where is the skill in craftsmanship in this knof? Yeah, he spelled knife wrong.
Yeah, that is a tough word. I mean, the K is silent. The O is super silent. But he threw.
Well,
it in
he spelled
there.
It. He spelled it correctly the first time. So
yeah, he spelled knives.
Yeah. Well,
maybe knof is the singular. Wherever he's from.
I just, you know, the thing that always strikes me is like, I don't really don't know what people get out of this, you know, like,
oh,
out of making comments like this, I'm just going to be like, oh shit, man, you're right. I'm sorry. Like,
yes, I'm still my money, man. I'll just take ass knives.
Yeah. I will admit I let myself get a bit catty. Normally I take the high ground, but in this case, I was just like, you know what?
Oh, did you respond?
Oh yeah.
And what did you say? Oh, yeah. You got to give us your response.
No, I don't want to read the whole thing.
Oh, it's long?
It's long. It's long.
Well, Luke,
you listen here,
like you
young
got a
whippersnapper.
Taste of your medicine.
my response did include shut the fuck up.
Nice.
So, yeah. I kept it classy, you know.
Did you say STF or STUF?
STFU.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I spelled it wrong, just like he spelled knife wrong.
Wah, wah. Yeah, you know, sometimes you just gotta let off steam. I deal with comments like this all the time, so it's sometimes like you just gotta fire back.
Well,
it's never gonna go anywhere productive.
This was directed right to you, but I almost find it worse when somebody will like comment on an Instagram post. They'll like tag a friend and be like, "Look at how ugly this is," and we're like, "You know, I get to see this too.
I'm right here, man. You're talking about me. I'm in the room."
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
that's an extra level of either ignorance or just like, I don't know, don't give a fuck.
Well, part of the reason why I wanted to include this is because like this little segment is because like, you know, like as much as I don't give a fuck about this person, these little comments, they still kind of hurt. They kind of like fuck your day up a little bit. You're like, oh,
for sure.
And the thing that makes me really sad about it is thinking about how many people have not shrugged this off. You know, I'm sure there's tons of like beginner knife makers, beginner guitar makers. They make their first guitar and they post it. And then someone's like, that's a piece of shit, bro. Like, kill yourself. Oh. Well, dude, I've literally had people on YouTube. I've posted a brand new video and they're like, I know what you're trying to do. I hope you fucking die.
Holy fuck.
You know, like, yeah, it's crazy, man. Like, people are nuts, you know? And I really worry about how many people get discouraged. So I want to share some of the discouragement that people are sending my way, so everyone realizes it's not just you.
That's a good thing to do. Maybe I can throw some into the ringer. I mean, it's rare that we get that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't get them. I don't get them every day or anything, but like at least once a month I get one where I'm like, oh, man.
And it could just be subtle too, though. It doesn't have to be like, this guy was really,
he went all out.
Yeah. Went for the kill. But it could be subtle. Like, no, I don't like it.
Yeah, that's fine though. Like, I don't mind that.
No, but why say it at all? Just don't like it.
I guess.
Just like what do they say? The greatest form of protest is not spending your money on it or something.
Yeah.
So just don't buy it. But
yeah.
Just be nice to us. I'm so tired.
Yeah. All right, everybody. On that note, I think that's a show.
Cool.
Yeah. Enjoy your week, everybody. We'll be back with more mean comments next
week.
Except
for you, Luke.
What else? We've still got some questions for next week, too. So we'll have a good show. And do you reckon your Haas will have made its first chips by then?
I hope so. We'll see.
Ooh. All right.
Some tools were loaded and probed. So I'm on the right track.
Everyone loves a good probing. So next week we'll either hear about some awesome chips or some awesome crashes. So
no.
Either way, it's going to be a great episode, everyone. Fingers crossed. Let's knock on wood. I'm knocking on my head right now.
I got lots of wood to knock on here.
There you go.
Do you have any? You just have
stupid
metal.
Yeah, I've got some fake wood next to me. All right, everyone. Have a great week, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.